that are there, welcome in to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I feel like I'm going to drop a freestyle right now.
I know. Like I saw your shoulders kind of moving back and forth.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. I'm not going to drop a freestyle. I will spare you that. But we are playing that music because it was featured at the DNC last night.
Yes.
As Pennsylvania submitted its roll call vote. If you don't know that track, it's the it's Wiz Khalifa from Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
The song is Black and Yellow. Big hit.
Yeah.
Many years ago.
Yeah, owe to the Steelers a little bit with the yellow.
Steelers, the Penguins, the Pirates. They love that color combination in Western Pennsylvania. And we'll talk about the DNC in a second, but the big topic today is housing.
Yes.
And because I knew that song was going to play, I looked this up.
Mm-hmm.
According to Redfin, the median home price in Pittsburgh.
Oh, goodness.
$250,000 last month.
Wow.
$250,000.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that price? Are we moving to Pittsburgh now?
It doesn't
I'm tempted.
It sounds pretty good. Not Philadelphia. It
not
sounds
bad
pretty
these
good.
Days. Not bad these days.
If you're from Washington, D.C., that is super cheap.
It sure is.
But if you're from Philly, that's a good price. But if you're from Pittsburgh, it might be
maybe
a little
not.
High.
I don't know. So today's topic, and we're going to get to this in the next segment, is housing in America. And we want to know, what are your biggest questions and concerns about housing? Are you looking for a house?
Mm-hmm.
Trying to sell? Perhaps you're a realtor trying to navigate these new rules. We want to hear from you today. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Yeah, we want to hear your story. Tell us, how has it been for you?
Yeah.
How has the market impacted your life? Have you been stuck in a house? You want to move? What's going on?
What's the situation?
Yeah.
Again. So the number again, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
And now our trio of stories from the region.
Start us off.
Yes. So I stayed up late again watching the DNC. And I have to say, Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, they were well represented during day two of the DNC. The headliners, of course, were Second Gentleman Doug Emhoff, former president, and First Lady Barack and Michelle Obama. By the way, Michelle Obama had everybody laughing in tears and feeling determined from the feedback I saw online. But before the speakers, there was that ceremonial roll call where state delegates pledged their votes to nominate Vice President Kamala Harris for president and Governor Tim Walz for VP and Pennsylvania representative. Governor Josh Shapiro proudly took the mic for the Commonwealth. Take a listen.
Pennsylvania cast 178 votes for the next Madam President of the United States, Kamala Harris, and Vice President Tim Walz.
Now, that's hard to announce. Whoa! Like that. It was great. It was great. And by the way, you know, he was very eager. You heard the black and yellow there. And he was flanked by a lot of Philadelphia area politicians. Our mayor, Sherelle Parker, was right there and very visible. House Speaker Joanna McClinton, Philadelphia City Council President Kenyatta Johnson, Democratic Party Chair, and Philly area State Senator Sharif Street. Definitely a Philly moment led by Shapiro.
He sounded like the Let's Get Ready to Rumble
guy. I know he did. Yeah. He did.
It's a second shot. Maybe you can moonlight.
He was great. It was great. It was like, it's hard to speak like that and to let your voice trail like that.
I wouldn't do it. Yeah.
As for speakers, State Representative Malcolm Kenyatta spoke. He's also running for Auditor General here in Pennsylvania. He spoke about Project 2025, about his grandmother, who he called a civil rights warrior, how she passed the torch to him. We also heard from Ann Wakabayashi, a political consultant and a delegate from Philly who's Asian American. And she talked about being from the AAPI community and having, you know, the Vice President Harris on the ticket, also about LGBTQ plus rights. And so that was, you know, Philadelphia represented and will be represented again. Pennsylvania will be represented again tonight.
Mm-hmm.
Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro is on the lineup.
Prime time, too.
Prime time.
Prime
yeah.
time. That's what you get as your sort of, you know, parting gift for not becoming the vice presidential nominee. You get to have a prime time speaking slot at the DNC.
Yeah.
So as we mentioned, they played that song Black and Yellow.
They did.
Which is a Pittsburgh song.
Pittsburgh.
But don't worry. They did start the roll call with Motown Philly by Boyz II Men.
Boyz II Men. Motown Philly.
Go ahead, sing it.
Anyway, I'm not going to do that.
No, do the whole thing. I got time.
Do a little East Coast swing.
There it is.
There you go.
Do you think that was the right choice? those two songs? You know, do a little Philly, do a little Pittsburgh.
Well, you need something that has a shoulder bop.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and I'm sure folks from the middle of the state, what about our music? But
I don't know what music that would be, to be perfectly
frank. But Philly
is what's a Harrisburg song? I don't know.
Ooh, good question.
The Penn State marching song? I don't know. I literally don't know. It could be something.
Are you throwing a little shade on me?
No, I'm just asking. I'm literally just asking the question. you remember? You wouldn't remember this song. It's called Lightning Crashes. It's by a band from in the middle of Pennsylvania. Never mind. It was a big hit in the
90s. Okay. By the way, tonight, the big headliner, of course, is Minnesota Governor Tim Walz, who will formally accept his nomination for vice president.
I think they should have gone with Hall & Oates because they're from Pennsylvania.
That is a good suggestion.
And they have sort of like this unmendable rift between them. And if the theme of the campaign is trying to sort of heal a divided country, play a little Hall & Oates to show that healing is possible.
Yeah. By the way, Jersey played the boss.
Speaking of Jersey, that's an obvious one. Yeah. New Jersey announced yesterday it is wiping away $100 million in medical debt. And I mean wiping away. There's no application. Just a bunch of people in New Jersey are about to get letters saying that money they owed, they don't owe it anymore. So New Jersey, by the way, is paying for all of this with COVID relief funds. $100 million in medical debt. But they're only actually using about $550,000 in federal funds to clear that debt. And that's because they're partnering with a nonprofit that buys bundled medical debt at a discount. Apparently a very steep discount. I don't exactly know the mechanics of how this works.
And then they're just going to wipe it away.
They wipe it away. $100 million in medical debt for nearly 50,000 people in the Garden State. The people receiving the relief are at or below four times the federal poverty level or have medical debts that equal 5% or more of their annual income. So a bunch of people in Jersey, I guess check your mailbox, are about to get letters saying all or part of their medical debt has been cleared by the state.
Governor Phil Murphy leading that effort there. Interesting. And I think it's kind of cool because medical debt can be crippling for folks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you don't want those debt collectors calling you and all those things. And so this is pretty nice.
And we talked about this before in a prior conversation. Oftentimes medical debt, or advocates argue, is not really indicative of your ability to pay future bills. And so people feel like it's an extra onus on, like, say, your credit rating, your credit worthiness. So New Jersey,
a lot of times you get sick, you go in, you have no idea what that bill is going to be when it comes out.
It's sort of out of your hands.
Yeah.
Let's move now to Philadelphia's beloved and perhaps underutilized waterways.
Yes. And there are multiple efforts right now in motion to spice up our waterways here in the city.
Spice them up.
And one we've spoken about previously is the I-95 cap that'll reconnect a section of Old City to the Philadelphia waterfront. There's a really cool article in the Philadelphia Inquirer that features some wonderful illustrations. They use artistic renderings to explain how the Philadelphia waterfront has changed over the last several decades and how the, you know, waterfront fell into disrepair.
This is the Delaware River waterfront.
Yeah, Delaware River waterfront.
To be clear.
Yes. And then how I-95 was built in the 70s, going right through Chinatown. And they explain now how this $325 million cap project will reclaim about two blocks of real estate between Chestnut and Walnut Streets, and the renderings really show you what it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
And that cap will cover I-95 and a portion of Delaware Avenue. It'll create a tunnel. And on top of all of that will be that 12-acre park. So you get to see that as you deal with all the traffic snares.
Yeah.
And the Schuylkill is also getting something really cool.
Getting a little facelift. All right. Can I interest you?
Yes.
In something called the Float Lab.
I thought it was cool. It looked cool.
I think it looks amazing. Yeah. So it's coming to the Schuylkill River. This is a project by Mural Arts, the nonprofit arts organization. This Float Lab is a lime green floating dock in the shape of a ring. And it's going to be in the Schuylkill River right around Bartram's Garden, southwest Philadelphia.
I like it. Mm-hmm.
And it's sloped. So at points when you're in this ring, you're basically like eye level with the river. So if you ever really wanted to see the Schuylkill River, like really
Which
get
Which I really
intimate,
haven't, but yeah, yeah. But yeah, they're cleaning it up. So
this Float Lab is for you. The work starts this fall. It's going to be complete by summer 2026. The Float Lab is coming to the Schuylkill River. So we're getting some improvements in the Schuylkill, some improvements
on
in
the
Delaware.
Waterfront.
And that could potentially, you know, boost home prices maybe
on
the Delaware or the
Schuylkill,
right? Because when you fix up a waterfront, people want to live there.
Yeah.
And so let's use that as a ding, ding, ding transition.
Yeah, to our questions. What are your biggest questions and concerns about housing in America? Are you looking for a house or trying to sell? Tell us your story. Call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And realtors want to hear from you as well about those new rules. And we're going out on a little East Coast swing. Studio 2, we'll be right back.
Sing it!
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Looking for a house, Cherry, is supposed to be, ideally, an exciting time, especially when you're looking for your first home. You know, combing through the listings, the pictures, going to the open houses. You know, we bought a home shortly before the pandemic in South Philly. And look, no home buying process is perfect, but the market seemed reasonable. Mm-hmm. There was stuff available. It was altogether, I think, a pretty pleasant and productive experience. But for people house hunting over the last few years, the market has been brutal, super competitive, record high prices.
Yeah, you probably heard the stories. But the question is, could things start getting more affordable? The Fed is likely to lower interest rates in September, and there are new rules that just went into effect around realtor commissions that will bring prices down a bit for buyers and sellers. So today, we're talking about the housing market, why it's been so difficult for buyers, and if better days are ahead. We have two experts in our studio. We have Kevin Gillen, Senior Research Fellow with the Lendy Institute for Urban Innovation at Drexel University. Welcome, Kevin.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Mike Coleman, realtor and adjunct instructor at Temple University's Real Estate Institute. Mike, welcome to Studio.
Thank you very much.
So, folks, what are your biggest questions and concerns about housing in America? Are you looking for a house? Are you trying to sell? Are you a realtor trying to navigate these new rules? Share your story. Call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2@whyy.org.
And I want to start the conversation with this comment from Noni, who says, prices are still too high for me to buy. I don't want to be house poor at this point in my life. And so my first question is for you, Kevin. I want you to talk about the current state of the real estate market in our region. And I want you to do that by comparing to what it used to be about 5 years ago. So when Avi bought his house. Tell us about the real estate market and compare to that.
Well, you led off the show with studying the statistic in Pittsburgh that the median price there is about 225 or 250.
250, yeah.
250. The last time the median house price in Philly was 250 was just 4 years ago, right before COVID.
No way.
That's how much it's appreciated. Right now, the median house price in the Philly metro area is nearly $400,000.
Whoa, wow. Whoa, whoa.
So that's over a $100,000 increase since COVID. And that's been primarily driven by two things. The very low interest rates that they implemented when COVID hit, because the economy went into a brief but very deep recession. And second of all, there was the huge shift in working from home. So all the money that people were spent going out when you're at work to lunch, going out after work for drinks and dinner, going to the theater, going to the museums, doing whatever, all that money that was being spent outside of your home, people started spending on their home. Mm. So as one realtor put it to me, your home just now wasn't where you live and where you work. It also became your home theater, your home gym, your home spa, because that's where you're spending all your time.
Yeah.
So why not upgrade it? So people were not only paying for homes high prices because money was cheap, they were also investing very heavily in their homes, which further boosted values, right? If you remodel your home, you typically expect it to go up in value. And that's what people were doing. So we've, you know, everyone knows about inflation since COVID, the general rate of inflation. House price inflation in our area has exceeded that by several times. $400,000 is the median price right now.
So let's bring in
You want to feel better, it's a median price in Manhattan is about $1.3 million.
Whoa.
That is
so
a
see,
nice
everything
ball.
Here is great.
That is a nice ball. Everything's relative, right? It's all about perspective. To get a perspective from one of our listeners now, I want to bring in Lou, who's on the phone. Lou is a property owner and doesn't want to sell, perhaps because of some of the things that Kevin is talking about. Lou, you're on Studio 2. What's your story? Lou, are you with us? I don't think we have Lou at this moment. Perhaps we can get him back later. So let's move on now. So what are you hearing? I want to bring in Mike Coleman now, realtor and adjunct instructor at Temple University's Real Estate Institute. Mike, what are you hearing from buyers and sellers out there in the marketplace locally?
Well, certainly concerned about the prices. I mean, they are still sky high, even if they come down a little bit since COVID. As far as affordability goes, there are people that are waiting for rates to come down. But the issue with that is, yes, it will be nice if that happens, but it's going to put a lot more buyers back into the market. One of my mortgage partners estimated, I think it's 5.5 million buyers will reenter for every 1 point drop in the rate. I don't know if you've seen that in your research as well, but if rates come down, you're now competing against that many more buyers. Mm. So it's going to push the prices back up in that case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we have Lou back.
Lou. We love you, Lou.
You are on Studio 2. I know you own a property and you don't want to sell. Lou, tell us your story. You're on Studio 2.
Oh, no. Still no Lou.
Okay.
This is the most elusive call in Studio 2 history, the great Lou. Well, maybe Lou is not for this episode, but Kevin Gillen, I want to bring it back to you. So we have this fundamental imbalance in the market. Prices are going up very steeply. So where does that leave your first-time buyers or prospective buyers, people that want to get into the game, that want to make this investment that's been the classic sort of upward mobility investment for Americans? Where does that leave the first-time buyers?
Well, it's the affordability issue that you mentioned is very, very real. To become a first-time home buyer right now, the median age of your typical first-time home buyer when you buy your so-called starter home is around 35 years. Prior to COVID, back in the teens, it was around 28 years or so. Okay, mm-hmm. So as homes have become, homes have not only appreciated significantly, but price growth has outpaced income growth. So the gap between what you can afford and what actual prices are is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, a very inequitable result. So it's particularly your young first-time home buyers, your Gen Zer types. They're getting married now. They're having kids. They're in their 30s. This is typically when you buy your first home. And that plus the fact that listings, the number of homes available for sale, is very low. It's starting to tick up, but it's still well below its historic average, means there's very little to choose from to begin with. So houses are not only unaffordable, the selection that's out there is very, very low. So what a lot of people are doing, and I hear this anecdotally from realtors all the time, is potential first-time buyers are saying, wait, so I'm supposed to pay a premium price for a home that's my third choice? Yeah, mom and dad's basement's pretty comfy right now. We're going to wait to see what the Fed does. And while you're correct that lower interest rates make financing more affordable and will bring both buyers and sellers back into the market, lower rates also act to increase house prices.
Right.
So you could have an increase in people coming back onto the market, so net demand has shifted up, right? That's going to push prices. But also because money's cheaper, that's going to push up prices again. So you can end up actually compounding the affordability issue as a result.
I want to ask because I hear what it's like for buyers, people looking for houses, and I wanted to hear from Lou and hear what the position is for sellers. So Mike, maybe you can shed some light on that. Because Lou didn't want to sell because there is probably no place for him to go. So what is it like for sellers in this market now that affordability is getting so out of reach?
Well, that's just it. So lots of sellers, of course, would love to take advantage of the high prices and pull their equity out. But then where are they going to go?
Right.
Are they going to be homeless? Are they going to rent? A lot of sellers have chosen to just rent for a while, take the cash out that they can access, rent somewhere, and wait till things cool off if that's ever going to happen. In fact, the apartment building I live in has a number of those sellers. But the other thing is, we've had a number of industry changes happen, which I'm sure we're going to get to, which has changed in the landscape of selling a home for both buyers, sellers, and the realtors that are involved. So all of these things are kind of at play right now, and it just happened in the last week, so it's yet to be seen how it's going to play out. But there are a lot of questions on the table at the moment.
Yeah, gridlock is what it sounds like to me.
It's called the lock-in effect.
The lock-in effect.
So it affects move-up buyers as much as it affects first-time buyers, the interest rate situation. People who bought their home, say, 5-10 years ago got a very, very low rate, right? Or even just 2 or 3 years ago when interest rates were especially low. Well, now rates are going up. So even if they can sell their home, which is it's a great time to sell, prices are at their peak, right? Well, where do you go? First of all, again, listings are very low. prices are at an all-time high. And what's more, you're going to end up paying a higher rate for your new home than your previous one. So, you know, the first-time buyers are saying, why should I overpay a high price for a home when the selection's so limited? It's my third choice home, not my first. Well, move-up buyers face a similar dilemma. Why should I sell my big house to move into a smaller home? Because these are older buyers, right? The kids are off to school, what have you. They're retiring. Who knows? So I'm you're telling me this. I'm going to move into a smaller home that's more expensive than my current home, and I'm going to have a higher mortgage payment because rates are high. So many people don't want to do that, and many people can't do that. I can't afford the higher mortgage payment, with rates being what they are, because I had a lower rate on my previous mortgage.
And if I could just add one thing to that. So one thing that we've seen a lot since COVID, it's unprecedented, at least for me. If you're 22, 23, and your friends are all out buying houses, don't get depressed by that. What they're probably not telling you is they have family contributing to the sale.
Mm.
And I've seen so much family money enter the market because parents have said, look, I have money in stocks or I have money in real estate. I was going to give it to my kids anyway. Why don't I give them a leg up now? I've seen more cash buyers in their 20s and early 30s that are writing six-figure checks from family gifts. And there's a lot of that happening right now.
And the implications of that being, I think, that, you know, the folks who come from families that could afford to buy a house in a prior generation are able to get in the market. If you're trying to break in, if you come from a family that did not have that advantage, it might be tough, is kind of what I'm reading into.
Absolutely.
That.
Yeah.
And by the way, the first-time home buyers are especially critical no matter what segment of the market you're in. I talk to, you know, wealthy people all the time. They're like, look, man, I've got a million-dollar-plus home in Gladwin. I'm not selling it to some 33-year-old Gen Zer who makes $65,000 a year. I'm selling it to someone just a few years younger than me who makes $250,000 a year, if not more. Well, here's why. As I'm sure Mike can verify with me, the housing market's like a chain of dominoes, okay?
Yeah.
You've got on one end, you've got your first-time home buyers. Then in the middle, you've got all your move-up buyers. And at the end, you've got your retirees or divorcees or people who are exiting the market. If that first domino doesn't tip, then the rest of the dominoes don't tip, or it takes longer to tip them. So even if you're selling a $2 million home in Gladwin and you're not targeting a 32-year-old, you need that 32-year-old to buy that first home,
in
Mount Airy. Yeah. The owner in Mount Airy then moves to Abington. And then someone in Abington sells their home and then buys your home in Gladwin.
Yeah. And by the way, if you're in any of those places, give us a call, 888-477-9499.
Yeah, and I want to bring in a caller from Mayor from Kutztown who wants to talk about affordable housing. You are on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
It's both. I'm wondering why we are responding to the housing crisis in the same way that we've responded to needs for increased housing in the past, in those ways that have increased sprawl, traffic, reduced biodiversity, and reduced our connectivity and community, when instead we could be rethinking how we do things, deconstructing some of our built environments, restoring ecosystems, and building long linear cities that are affordable and to scale.
Could you just clarify that a little bit, Mayor?
Well, you could, as a reference, Paolo Soleri, an old architect, designed long linear cities that follow geological patterns and paired very nicely with the rewilding. And if you don't know what that is, you can look at rewilding.org. That will help us restore our ecosystem, but also provide benefits socially because you bring communities back together. So you have elderly living in community with young families.
So, Mayor, is your central concern that there's going to be overdevelopment or overbuilding? Is that what you're getting at? I'm just trying to get to the heart of it so I can redirect it to our panel.
Okay, so it's multiple concerns, but what I experience personally is I live in the Lehigh Valley area, which is one of the greatest it's one of the most being developed right now in the country. And all I see are more and more farm fields, and I've seen this for the past 30 years, but now it's at this astronomical rate. All these farm fields getting chewed up to put in these expensive, ugly apartments and housing complexes, and they isolate people, forcing us to build more roads with more traffic, more emissions, more pollution. We've lost biodiversity and the habitat there.
And Mayor, we're going to leave it there.
Thank you so much, Mayor. I just wanted to make sure I understood your comment. Yeah. Thanks for going back and forth with me there. So let me redirect that now to Kevin Gillen. So look, the obvious way out of this problem is to build, right, to increase supply, I assume. But then you also get pushback because that can lead to suburban sprawl, exurban sprawl, destruction of habitat. So what is the way out of this locked-in gridlock effect?
We only have half an hour left. this is one of the biggest questions that housing economists, real estate economists get asked.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can tell you that I do a lot of public speaking at events, community meetings, conferences, et cetera. And I can tell you that people will get upset whether you tell them, we're going to build, we're not going to build, or we're going to wait to build. No matter what you say, people will find something to complain about. And not without reason. So what our previous caller was talking about, is why are we consuming so much additional green space
right.
rather than building up at greater densities where we have existing infrastructure
right.
and existing development, and suburban sprawl being the class of symptom. First of all, I can tell you that right now, from just a narrow economic perspective, one of the reasons we have such affordability problems is we're not building enough.
Yeah.
If I showed you a chart of new home construction going back the last 25 years, it peaked during the housing bubble, okay? Right now, new home construction in the U.S. is still well below where it was during the peak years in the bubble. So we're still running below our historic average. We're not, and new homes, like I talked about the domino effect, most new homes tend to be more upscale homes for the upper end of the market, primarily because of construction costs. Building a new home is much more expensive. A new home is always more expensive than an existing home, right? Because it's brand new. It's got all the amenities, the advanced technology. It could be green, sustainable. You know, the typical home in Philadelphia County is 100 years old.
Yeah.
All right, row homes in North Philly do not have solar panels on the roof. You know, they're not. They need to be weatherproofed. They're physically depreciated. They have, you know, very narrow floor plans. People like wide open spaces, not multiple rooms, which they used to have because it was more. It was cheaper to heat a place when you had lots of small rooms than a big open space, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But construction costs have gone up so much, and this happened during COVID with the supply chain choke points. You not only have materials being more expensive, because so much of materials, your sheetrock, your steel, your lumber is imported, okay? But you also have labor costs going up because we simply don't have enough young people entering into the building trades.
Yeah.
Most young people still think that the way to make money in this world is to go to college, get at least a four-year degree, and then become a professional. The building trades pay very, very well, especially in our region if you're union, which mm-hmm. we are primarily a union. You know, we're not Texas or Arizona. You know, a master carpenter or plumber or electrician can make close to six figures a year. And they don't have the student debt of hundreds of thousands of dollars mm-hmm. from going to a four-year school.
So labor is high, materials are high.
And because they were not building enough new homes, and like I said, the domino effect, you need to build new homes. Again, they're at the other end of the domino chain to allow the move-up buyers to move up to free up that first-time home
right.
for the first-time buyer.
And so there's a lot of different parts of mm-hmm. this chain. And I want to bring in, I want to talk a bit about one of the solutions that was offered. VP Harris, Vice President Harris, has recently released a plan that would provide a home buyer up to $25,000 for down payment assistance.
For first-time home buyers,
as well as a $10,000 tax credit. There's also tax incentive for home builders to build more starter homes. Would that help? And is the government the right entity to sort of help step in?
It's well intended, but this is the consensus view among most economists, whether you're politically left, right, or center. If you want things to be more expensive, you subsidize it. If you want to make things cheaper, you can actually tax it, but you can put people out of business too. This is viewed as primarily giving a cash injection to house prices. So it might allow people to buy more homes, but it's going to boost prices. I mean, if I just gave you $25,000 and said, here, you can only spend it on buying a home, then you now have an additional $25,000 you can use to buy a home. Mm-hmm. The sellers know that. So they'll jack their prices by $25,000, maybe even more, or maybe just a little less. But they've jacked their prices because they know you've got more money in your pocket being a first-time home buyer.
Yeah, and Harris, we want to hear from you. Can we get the number out? We want to hear from you. What will help make homes more affordable for you? What do you think? Is owning a home used to be a building block in our finances? What do you think? Give us your story. Call us 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And realtors, we also want to hear from you.
So you mentioned that if you subsidize people entering the market, Kevin Gillen, that could increase prices. But Harris also wants to do supply side reforms to try to make it easier to build, to cut red tape. I think the question that I have looking at those proposals is whether the federal government really has enough control in this area to move the needle. Because it sounds, to me, it sounds nice to try to subsidize demand, but also increase supply at the same time to make these two things move in concert somewhat. And I guess my question is whether it can be effective. What do you think?
I'd like to hear from Mike some more on this too, but I'll contribute one thing on this. Like I said, I speak at a lot of industry conferences and do a lot of builders. If you ask them who their number one compliance is, compliance meaning dealing with government, who it is, they'll say local officials,
not
state, not federal.
Right.
Yeah,
traditionally in America, unlike, say, Europe or even Asia, the zoning laws, building codes, these are all determined locally, municipality to municipality, county to county. When a developer needs to assemble parcels to build, because there's big economies of scale in home building, you don't want to build a one-off home here and a one-off home there. You want to build 50 homes in one space, like our previous caller mentioned.
Yeah.
Because it actually, that may not look pretty from an environmental perspective or an aesthetic perspective, but it makes those homes cheaper because they can build 100 units in the same place.
It's cheaper like to build. Anything. Doing something in bulk makes it more
bulk,
economical.
Right. Yeah. But it's the local people they have to deal with. Well, that can vary from township to township. One thing I hear from developers is that historically it used to be a real pain to build in Philly because neighborhood opposition. But over time, the city has become more pro-housing.
Hmm.
And as long as you take in the community's input into your plan and allow them to come to the meetings and say what they'd like, and they'd like you to add some public green space to your apartment, project, whatever, donate a wing to this local school, people are more amenable to you building the city. It's the suburbs that have become anti-building because they want to preserve their green space. They don't want additional congestion, parking issues, things like that. They don't want additional kids in the schools. If you really want to get flamed at a community meeting in the suburbs,
tell
them you're going to build a transit-oriented development apartments for low-income people next to the SEPTA station.
And Mike,
you'll be run out on a rail.
And Mike, we want to get your take on that.
Yeah, so I live in a very hotly contested development. I live in the King of Prussia Town Center. Mm. And King of Prussia did not want that at all, many of the residents. It was a golf course. It wasn't really being used. And so the plan came to put the Wegmans up, the typical town center you see coming up all over the country. And they fought it for 10 years.
Wow.
Even though it wasn't really a used space. But it was the congestion argument. It was the traffic. It was going to bring in all kinds of crime.
Kids in the schools. That's the big one.
The kids in the schools. And eventually it got passed. We've got thousands of luxury units that went up. And I guarantee you, most of the people that fought that are there in the restaurants right now having lunch and enjoying the courtyard and the space that was created.
The question, I guess, that it goes back to for me, though, is if all the opposition tends to be local, and here you have someone like Kamala Harris, and Trump has talked about this, too, trying to increase housing supply. I still wonder, can the federal government do that? Do they have the tools they need to do that, or is it kind of just wishful thinking? Do you have a thought on that?
I mean, Mike, I'm all for affordable housing. I'm on the board of a nonprofit that provides 600 beds for people. I think we need that. We need any program that will help people get into homes. But my concern would be if we're going to just hand people $25,000.
Right.
Just making sure that they're qualified to keep that house.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to hand people money to get them into a property and then have them go into foreclosure, which is what happened during the subprime lending days.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we had the crash that we had, because people were getting loans that they shouldn't have gotten. And they ended up going through significant hardship as a result.
Mm.
So if we're going to have these programs, let's have them, but make sure we have programs in place to continue to keep those people in their homes.
So we're going to go to a break right now, but we get to the other side. I want to talk a little bit about these new rules for realtors, because if you're going to get into the market now, if you're a first-time buyer, you're going to have at least somewhat different experience than someone who was getting into the market a month ago, 2 months ago. There are new rules. They come out of this settlement from a lawsuit. So we're going to explain that. We're going to break it down. I think hopefully, Mike, you'll be able to help us explain to buyers what they can expect.
Yeah. And we also are going to hear from a realtor who's on the line right now. So hold on. And we also want to hear from you. What are your biggest questions and concerns about housing in America? The number is 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back, everybody, to our home, Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We're focusing on housing today. It's been a difficult time for home buyers with so many people priced out of the market. So what will help make homes more affordable? Owning a home used to be the basic building block for the middle class. Is that still achievable? And is it still the best investment? We want to hear from you. You can call us 888-477-9499 or email studio2 at whyy.org.
Let me reintroduce our lovely guests. Kevin Gillen is Senior Research Fellow with the Lindy Institute for Urban Innovation at Drexel. Mike Coleman is a realtor and adjunct instructor at Temple University's Real Estate Institute.
And we want to bring in a caller. Michelle is a realtor and wants to talk about how Philadelphia already has some programs for home buyers. Michelle, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment here?
So you were talking about how last night Kamal was talking about a $25,000 grant for people. Well, we currently have a program called KFIT, which is 5% of the purchase price.
Okay.
So Michelle's saying this. So Michelle's saying, you cut off there, but I think Michelle's saying there are some tools already for those first-time home buyers.
And it
buyers.
May not necessarily be helping. Would you say, Mike, there needs to be more?
I mean, I think you could argue there always could be more. Mm-hmm. There are programs like what Michelle's referencing out there to help. You know, there's second grants you can get, which if you keep the home for a certain amount of time, you don't have to pay it back. Those are in existence right now. But I hadn't heard about Kamala Harris's plan, but I would definitely be interested in learning more about it.
And can we shift gears a little bit? Because, Mike, we want to talk about these new rules that just came out. Can you talk about how they will change the process of buying a home?
Yeah, so that's the talk of the hour right now across the industry. For one, I would say it remains to be seen everything that's going to change from these new laws.
And to be clear, these rules affect realtors and how home buyers and sellers can negotiate commissions.
Yes.
Well, they directly affect realtors, but indirectly anyone who's in the market.
Home buyers, yeah.
Sure. So you want me to give it to you in a nutshell?
Yeah.
Give it to us.
So, you know, I've been in this for 15 years. For as long as I've been doing this, we've had something in Pennsylvania called buyer agency. Not every state has had that. And if they don't have buyer agency, that means the listing agent typically represents both the buyer and the seller. And buyers do not have their own separate representation from the seller. In Pennsylvania, since 1999, we've had the concept of buyer agency. And historically, in almost every case, the commissions have been fully paid by the seller. Seller pays a commission. It gets split evenly between the buyer broker and the listing broker. And that's how the agents get paid. The lawsuit that was filed basically alleged that us realtors were lying to the public and deceiving them and not fully educating sellers on the possibility that a buyer could compensate their broker and agent themselves. Mm. We just put this out there as a status quo, which it really has been. It's always been possible for a buyer to pay, but it just hasn't been historically what happened. And so the allegation was that we were essentially taking money out of the seller's pockets that they shouldn't have had to pay. Mm. Mm. And because of that, the new changes that are in place have changed what displays in the multiple listing service, the MLS, as you guys may have heard. Mm-hmm. That's where all of the properties are typically listed and sent out to all the consumer-facing sites. Compensation offers can no longer be displayed publicly in any kind of multiple listing service. And because of that, also, to take a buyer out on showings, now a contract is required. That might sound common sense, but practice typically has been for many agents to take a buyer out, see a few homes, build a rapport. If you haven't met them before, they may not be ready to sign a contract with you right away. Now, we cannot take a buyer out to see a single home without a contract in place outlining what our fee for our services is and saying that, yes, if the seller's paying, we will take their money, but the seller may not be paying a commission and the buyer will then be on the hook for it.
And I want to bring in now a voice from a realtor who actually is in favor of these changes. This is Matt. Let's hear what Matt has to say. This is on our voicemail line.
Hi, my name is Matt Neuwirth, and I'm a realtor based out of Reading. And in my opinion, the changes that have come are good because it creates more transparency between home sellers, purchasers, and realtors.
So there you go. So the idea that there's going to be transparency, like before you ever go and see a house, you're going to sign a contract with your agent, your buyer's agent, and that person is going to say, this is how I'm going to be compensated. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that, Mike Coleman?
I'm generally in favor of it as well. I think a few positive things are going to happen. I think one, it is going to, of course, in some cases, save sellers some money. Mm-hmm. You know, they can choose to, you know, what they're going to pay, and they can put some of the onus of the commission onto buyer agents. It is going to result, I think, in some agents leaving the business because it's going to get harder. It's going to require a higher level of negotiating skill on behalf of the agent, which some people just don't have.
So the industry might contract.
It will. I'm very certain that it will. And I don't think that's a bad thing because there's a lot of agents out there right now and not that many homes to sell.
Yeah.
The other thing is I have buyers right now. I've been fortunate that my most recent buyers are kind of in the upper end of the price point. Yes, they can afford to pay the commission, right? But when we talk about affordability and first-time buyers, we're talking about people that are getting FHA loans or low down payment programs that simply don't have the extra money to pay their agent. And my concern there is they're going to choose to go unrepresented. They're going to end up in a dual agency position, which I typically don't recommend they do.
And that's when the selling agent represents both people in the transaction, which is sort of a conflicted position for someone to be in.
I'm going to get a lot of flack for this among my colleagues, but I am dual agency is allowed in Pennsylvania, but I am staunchly against it. You cannot.
So you're worried that some folks will be taken advantage of.
For sure.
Yeah.
And I want to bring in another voicemail, and I want you to comment on this, Mike. Jennifer, she is a broker from Princeton who sees the downsides to this new rule. Let's take a listen.
This is Jennifer E., located in Princeton. Sellers have always been able to decide how they want to share or not share a commission. I'm concerned about our first-time home buyers and our buyers understanding how well they will do when they have a team that's informed for them.
That was your point.
Yeah, that was your point. And will first-time homebuyers be sort of left out there without that type of negotiation support?
Yeah, I mean, that's the concern because, you know, as an industry, we have to do a really good job of explaining the value of having representation. Yeah. A lot of buyers, especially first-time, may just not understand the value of having someone who has a fiduciary duty to you and you only. And they may end up going straight to the listing agent thinking they're going to save some money. In that case, you now have someone who's working for the seller, who's also working for the buyer. And while, again, we can do that here, and I have done it a couple of times in very specific circumstances, I really believe, generally speaking, that you cannot represent opposite parties in a transaction and truly fulfill your full duties as an agent.
Let's bring in another caller. This is Christopher from Maple Shade. He is a homeowner who also had some friends who were looking for a home, so maybe you can see both sides of this. Christopher from Maple Shade, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi. About last year, a couple friend of mine, one of them is a veteran who had the home buying assistance that the federal government gives to veterans, moved in with us while they were closing on a house. It fell apart. The sellers backed out and ended up selling for cash to somebody else. And then three or four other deals fell apart, and we found out most of them were to institutional investors who were buying houses and turning them into rental properties. And even though they both had jobs and even though she had this assistant that qualified her for these homes, she was never able to close a deal. And that's my comment.
That's really interesting.
And there, we also have a comment here that says that talks about the need for government to step in and put a cap on the number of residential properties that folks are able to buy and then turn into rental properties.
Yep.
Can you talk about that impact? Because I know a lot of people who are making a lot of money right now, bought dozens of homes over the past several years and really gotten into the real estate market. Okay.
Well, I can tell you that builders and investors who are converting properties from owner-occupied to renter-occupied, don't drive the market. They're not professional drivers. They're professional followers. Mm. They're doing this because the demand is there because young people can't afford to buy a home. So what do? It's either mom and dad's basement or you rent. And most of them now make a sufficient income that they're renting. They may not want to rent, but that's what they're doing because that's the only option that's available to them. So if demand is shifting towards renting, they're just responding to that. I understand you may not like what they're doing, but again, they're just responding to the signals that the market is sending them. Rental housing right now is typically cheaper than owner-occupied housing. I mean, you know, what you pay in an average monthly rent for a comparable unit in an owner-occupied home is cheaper. This happened a lot during COVID, and that's why so many Gen Zers, they were saving money, and because their savings increased, they have a higher down payment. They paid down their debt, so they're qualified to be homeowners. But now they're going out and finding that the listings aren't there, and prices are just still out of reach because it's grown faster than they've been able to save money or get a raise at work, right? So the surge in rentals that we're seeing, again, is just a normal organic response to what the conditions of the market. There's no conspiracy here. But there is, I think, a bit of a glut here in Philadelphia and many other metro areas of rental housing. I know that we're particularly in the city. Almost all new housing that was built during the bubble years in Philadelphia were condos. Now, condos are owner-occupied. They're high-dent. They may look like apartments, but they're owner-occupied. This time around, during this cycle, it's been rental housing.
Rentals, yeah.
Particularly, the areas that are revitalizing, gentrifying, whatever term you want. Your fish towns and university cities and places, brewery towns, places like that. And as a result, the Gen Zers and younger renters know this. And they're doing what's called concession surfing. In general, developers are loath.
What do you got for me?
Developers are loath to lower rents, okay? Because that determines the value of the property. It's basically your discounted cash flow of your rental income stream. So the more you lower rents to get people into your units, the less valuable your property is. Because typically what most developers do, they build, they lease the place up, and then they sell it, move on to their next project.
But there's a loophole.
Right. But what you can do is offer concessions, which is like an in-kind lowering of your rent. So I'm going to give you the first 3 months free. I'm going to give you a free bike parking spot. I'm going to give you a free pass to the dog park that we built on the roof. Things like that, And by the way, Gen Zers love their dog parks. They love them.
Actually, the dog park by my house.
Yeah, if you can't, they're getting married older, besides becoming homeowners later. And so they're having kids later. And so the dogs are like surrogate kids.
Yeah, the pre-kid.
And Kevin, I have a quick follow-up for you, because when I bought my first home, it right before the housing bubble, right? And then I bought this house. Next thing you know, 2 years later, I was underwater in the mortgage. And then, of course, several years later, the price went all the way up. You're able to make back your income. Is this just part of the cycle? Is what we're dealing with right now just part of the cycle?
It is. It's just that it's... For most people who are less than 60 years of age, they haven't experienced this before.
Mm-mm.
So they think it's new, or it's some we're living in bizarro world that it's...
Well, I'm not 60,
I know you're not. But the cliche, real estate is cyclical, right, Mike?
Right.
Of course. And there's a reason that cliche exists. Just because it's cliche doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah.
Most of the issues that you see happening in real estate have occurred before. That's why.
So will they clear themselves up without further intervention?
Mm-hmm. Well, often the intervention, in the short term, people will want a policy intervention by government. I understand that. And often interventions can be good and they can be called for. I think focusing on the cost of building homes and the very lengthy process it takes before you actually break ground are the two areas that government can help the most. I mean, streamlining the permitting process, especially if you're building housing for first-time buyers, low-income housing, I think you should get fast-tracked. And I think most people would agree with that, whether you're left, right, or center, politically speaking, right?
So let me ask now. So if more and more folks are delaying buying homes and they're just renting, but they're not building equity that way, the question is, what happens to the way that we build, personal wealth in this country? And what happens to community if sort of rental is the common mode of living somewhere versus ownership? And Pedro from New Jersey asks, why is buying a home considered an investment? I mean, that's a core question here.
Two very good questions. Two answers to that. First of all, home ownership is no longer the only way to wealth in America.
Yeah.
I mean, who doesn't have an index fund or a 401k? You can buy one online, just a few clicks. And most people who at least have a college degree do. I'm all in favor of financial education for people who don't have a college degree. I think that's one area government could make a very positive impact to low-income households, young people in the inner city, just how to balance a checkbook, how to save, showing them how compound interest works. Get your money into an index fund online as soon as you can, the younger you are, and let compound interest work its magic in your favor. So you can build wealth without owning a home. But I think the social effects and political effects of a low home ownership rate are actually more concerning to me than the economic effects.
It's that personal investment in the neighborhood you live in.
When you buy a home, you effectively become a shareholder in your community, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. Because it drives the value of your home. Suddenly, you start caring about the condition of the home and its worth. You care about the quality of your public services, especially schools. You care about public safety. You become invested in your community, right? You care about those things. You start going to community meetings and you know, calling your city council.
You're rooted.
You're engaged, right? Mm-hmm. Renters, I've been a renter. I was young once. I used to ride a bike because I lived in Center City. I didn't have a car. I brought my mountain bike into my apartment. I banged the hell out of the stairwells and the walls.
It's not yours anyway.
It wasn't mine.
Yeah. And that's you weren't painting those walls.
I wasn't trying to be a jerk. Yeah. The building was all students. We all banged the hell out of the places and threw crazy parties. But once you got a family and you own that place, you take care of something that you own much better than something you rent.
There's a consideration for cultural fabric. And yes. I just want to make sure I give Mike Coleman another chance to respond here. Mm-hmm. You know, you're a younger guy. What do you think about a future where young people just don't fundamentally build wealth in the same way that people did a generation ago? I know we're getting very big picture here. We have about 45 seconds.
Yeah. I mean, I think to reiterate, we absolutely could do a better job of financial literacy for our young people, which should start in really middle and high school. I certainly didn't have that when I was in high school. And I think that, you know, yes, there are more than one way to build wealth. I truly think real estate's always going to be one of the biggest drivers. Mm. You know, that's something I'm focused on as far as generational wealth for my family. But there are other ways. I just think that, you know, if you look at the most wealthy families in America, most of them have some sort of real estate holdings.
Yeah.
And so I think that's always going to be a critical component. But absent that, we need to educate people on what their other options are to be able to survive when they're in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s.
It's going to be a balance, it sounds like. It's going to be a balance.
And there's the hope that more people can get into this market. Thank you to our guest, Kevin Gillum, Senior Research Fellow with the Lendy Institute for Urban Innovation at Drexel University, and to Mike Coleman, Realtor and Adjunct Instructor at Temple University's Real Estate Institute. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
And thank you to our listeners. That is it for today's edition of Studio 2. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Al Banks is our engineer. Kevin McCory is our executive producer from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us today.